This is Dory Smith for Regime Change Radio, a half-hour program on the importance of voting to bring about regime change in America. The occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq put heavy demands on the military to find more people. General Peter Pace, vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs, told reporters at a press conference February 17th, held at the Council on Foreign Relations, that the present force can be restructured to meet the changing demands. But there is legislation calling for a draft in both the House and Senate. The Defense Department has issued calls for people to fill posts at draft boards, and there are extensive recruitment operations underway with ROTC and U.S. military veterans working for the Foss Institute and Oliver North. They say they are committed to visiting millions of American students to try to instill their version of patriotism in them. Today, Stephen Pope of Santa Barbara, California, talks about his vocation as a counselor to those who do not wish to be drafted. A Quaker, Pope was a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War. He must take time out from his work as a professor of music at the University of California, Santa Barbara, to counsel young Americans. The following websites have more information on the possibility of a U.S. military draft and what you have to do if you do not want to become a member of the military. These sites will be provided again at the end of the program. They are the American Friends Service Committee, AFSC.org, the Center on Conscience and War, NISBCO.org, and StopTheDraft.org. The GI Rights Hotline number is 1-800-394-9544. Professor Stephen Pope, welcome to Regime Change Radio.
It's good to be talking to you.
Now, I wondered your first reaction to learning that the United States was going to go to war in Iraq. What were your thoughts as a former conscientious objector during the Vietnam era?
Well, it wasn't a surprise, given all the buildup that took place in the media, that it was the thing we had to do. People in the progressive movement were already aware of the Partnership for the New American Century, and that they were basically looking for a reason to invade Iraq because it was hurting our economy that the Iraqi oil was not on the open market. And we couldn't relax the embargo and the sanctions we had against Iraq after the Gulf War of 1991, which we, of course, now call Oil War I, without losing face, of course, George Bush's the senior's son could not relax those sanctions. And on the other hand, we needed to control that oil so that we could break the back of the OPEC cartel. So it seemed like a very, very logical thing to say we have to invent whatever reason is necessary to go in, depose Saddam Hussein, and get control of the second largest reserves of oil in the world. So for many of us, it was just surprising how long it took them to start connecting the attacks in New York of September 11th with Iraq. I would have thought they would have started the afternoon of September 11th instead of going around the whole red herring almost of Al-Qaeda terrorist groups and Afghanistan. I'd have thought their first priority would have been to say, this was done by Iraq, let's go take over Iraq.
And it seems that military analysts, experts within the military system, are telling people, like David Lindorf, who writes for Salon magazine, that if it turns out to be a continuous, long, hard slog in Iraq, then we're certain to see a draft of some kind. And so the question is going to be, what is it going to look like, and are they going to dare to use the word draft?
Well, there are two issues raised by that question. The first is, how did we make such big mistakes about how difficult it would be to restore order in Iraq, mistakes about what is the actual state of repair of the Iraqi oil industry, and mistakes about what kind of procedure should we use with the Iraqi organization that we found, specifically the army and the existing government. And it's very difficult for conspiracy theorists to say, boy, the CIA and the right-wing movement made huge, terrible mistakes. And if you're a conspiracy theorist, you want to think that they're smarter than they actually are. In terms of the troop numbers that are necessary to maintain now at least three fronts, because we have very major military establishments in South Korea, in Afghanistan, and in Iraq, to say nothing of the other concentrations around the world, from Europe to Central America, we're fighting a three-front war. You don't have the tens of thousands of troops we have in South Korea without considering that a Cold War situation. And it is, of course, once our military planners look at the options of having a long-term presence in Iraq on the order of tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of soldiers, this has a very large impact in the kind of troop levels they need to plan to supply. In the past 20 years almost, since the dissolution of the draft at the end of the Vietnam era, it's been an all-volunteer army, which, of course, all-volunteer just means they have ways of enticing people to come, and what we refer to it as is an economic draft. They offer people cash, they offer people training, they offer people money to go to college. So it's not volunteers, it's people who are just on the cusp of wanting to get some training but not having the financing, or being accepted into a college but not being able to pay the tuition without going through some other means. So we have a draft now, it's just not a uniform draft, it's an economic draft. If you look at the characteristics, the profiles of people who come into the military, it is very obvious that they come from lower middle to middle class. They're people who often are not at the bottom of their school classes. They're kind of in the middle. They're the people who do have the motivation and the desire to get some higher training, to have a professional career rather than a career as a laborer, but they're the people who don't have the means to go to a four-year college or to get the kind of vocational training they want. Planners now are looking at reinstating a uniform draft, and this is, again, an issue where the progressive movement is very, very split. Some people say it would be good to have a draft again. It would be good to have no exemptions whatsoever, because that would make us all the more conservative about going to war in foreign countries, if even senators' sons and daughters had to go serve in the military. Other progressives say it would be good to have a draft as long as it included options for civil service. And this is the system that is practiced in almost all other developed countries, that they have a 1.5 to 2 year required national service, but that it's very easy to elect to do a passive civil service, such as driving an ambulance or working in a mental hospital or being a teacher's aide, rather than going into the military.
The military has instituted stop loss. And so in light of that, do you think that anyone should believe that alternative service and perhaps waiting in the wings while foreign policies change is a safe place to be?
Well, the current stop-loss measure is very, very obviously a temporary stopgap, because the Republican Party does not want to institute the draft during an election year. It would exacerbate the debate about our presence in Iraq in the first place. So I think we can pretty much assume that this is a very temporary thing, just to keep the discussion of the draft out of the election process, and that if it were any other year other than an election year, we would have a draft. The bills that are now already being circulated in Congress would all reinstate the draft in January 2005. And I think at that time, the mistreatment of current military, and it's actually, I've heard several reports saying that even according to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, this is completely illegal. I don't think that's a long-term concern. I think after the election, that will be resolved by the reinstatement of a uniform draft.
Now, what the U.S. military has been reporting, and this is available online within the website of the Project on Defense Alternatives, they've actually published a copy of an unclassified Army report that calls for the use of a transfer of jobs, essentially, and these are going to be new positions, new kinds of training that the troops are going to be doing. It's a huge, huge effort, and it's going to have a price tag on it of $20 billion. The jobs that these people are going to be doing are going to have less to do with, let's say, the kinds of artillery jobs that the invasion force into Iraq would have done, and more with the kinds of high-tech technical positions that go along with everything from maintaining an oil rig to doing propaganda and to working as police in a war zone. What does that say to you?
Well, it's important to look historically at the evolution, the continuing evolution of our personnel and the use of personnel in the military. It's as continuous and as radical as the evolution of the weapons that we give these personnel. The last traditional war that we fought was in Korea, where you had tanks and artillery stations and normal fronts. Starting in Vietnam, we were faced with guerrilla warfare, we were faced with very large areas that were infiltrated by both parties. So starting already 30 years ago, the military has been revamping and restructuring what their troops do. And the notion that we had from Oil War I, from the first Gulf War, that all you need is artillery, that you fight war with tanks and airplanes and cruise missiles, that was a very nice propaganda movie. That's not the way war is fought these days. Especially now, if you look at our role, the U.S. role as sole superpower, the Republican right now is preparing us to be policemen for the world, not just single superpower, but to say we are going to be very actively involved in nation building, in maintaining order, in propaganda, in repairing infrastructure. So this is just a new role for the military, but it's completely in line with the agenda of the Partnership for the New American Century and the Republican Party, that we will use our military not just to project force in terms of artillery and cruise missiles, but to go in afterwards and provide administration, technical support, infrastructure repair, etc., in these countries that we decimate. And right now, we're faced both in Afghanistan and in Iraq with very, very huge problems due to the fact that we don't have a military that is prepared to go in and serve as the government.
We have heard from the candidates their positions on the war as a leading question in the debates. Yet, in spite of the fact that we're talking about war and war topics, no one is discussing how we're going to manage these increasing demands on the forces without a draft. Do you think that that's going to develop soon, or are we just going to see the year go by with that question not being raised?
Well, it brings up two big issues. Your question touches, first of all, on who is managing the election. What we mostly hear about the election comes filtered through the Fortune 500-dominated media. And there's very obviously an agenda there to keep this whole issue out of the news. I don't think it's a surprise that the only major candidate who was very openly against the war was forced by the media to drop out. And Howard Dean, whether or not you like Howard Dean as a candidate, the whole way the media played up his one shout that he gave after his returns in the Iowa caucuses, the fact that that was played up into some huge thing, saying this guy is a nut or something, it seemed to me like it was, okay, they were looking for anything necessary to get rid of Howard Dean. And the fact that all other major candidates that are getting any kind of press don't really want to talk about the war that closely because they supported it, and the fact that the candidates who are very loudly against it, like Denis Kucinich, are not getting any press coverage, I think the first thing to look at there is saying, who's controlling our information about the war? And the more I talk to people and try to stimulate activism, the more I tell people, don't listen to the American media. Read The Guardian or read Libération in France or subscribe to World Press Review, a tremendous English-language monthly newsletter magazine that is primarily culled from the world press. And it's very disturbing how controlled our media are, and I think that also includes National Public Radio, which is also primarily dependent on the Fortune 500 for their funding. The second part of the question is, what will happen, even given a free press, which we don't have, what would happen in the debates and in the two major parties? And this is something that's so divisive, both of conservatives and especially of progressives, that I don't think anybody wants to talk about draft. I don't think anybody wants to talk about Iraq 3 years down the road. For the conservatives, they just as well have the motto be, well, the Iraqi war ended on May 1st, and now it's just some little skirmishes while we get things straightened out. And in the Democratic Party, it's so difficult because most of the party did support the war, and how can they now look back and say, well, that was a pretty huge mistake that cost some number of hundreds of American lives and some number of tens of thousands of Iraqi lives. So I think it's something that nobody really wants to touch.
When you think about the media and the way the war was sold and where we are now in all of that with the campaign going on, would you say that there's now a more clearly defined propaganda program underway in the United States?
I think there's been a very clearly defined propaganda machine controlling our media for at least a decade, and I don't think it's more well-defined now. The main difference is it's being more successful. People are critical of it less and less, and it's easier and easier for them to brand any critical thinkers as being radical liberal wackos. So I think the propaganda machine of the Fortune 500 controlled media has been quite a big success, at least since Oil War I. Right now, the thing is, it's harder and harder for progressives to even find the information. The good progressive news sources we have, be it The Nation or Pacifica Radio or what have you, are unfortunately getting more and more marginalized.
If you go online and you read the web pages of both John Kerry and John Edwards, leading Democratic candidates, you don't find anything at all about the draft. You don't find anything at all about existing legislation calling for the draft. No answers to that question, selective service at all. Instead, what you do find are statements like this one. This is John Edwards, and he would ask that there be homeland security scholarships. Scholarships to young people willing to pursue homeland security, professions where individuals are in short supply. And he cited foreign language translators, public health workers, monitoring for bioterrorist attacks as examples of professions that could be done as community service. If you go online and look at John Kerry's website, he calls for the creation of an army of patriots. And that would mean to him a goal of 1 million Americans a year in national service within the next decade. That would be mandatory national service. And again, I would ask the question of someone like yourself who's expert on draft issues. Is this just another way to create a huge reserve of Americans to stand ready in case of foreign policy initiatives determining that they're needed in a war zone?
That's exactly what it sounds like, but that's what nobody wants to say. It's very unpopular to talk about reinstating a draft, especially if you're trying to get elected president, especially if you're coming from the left-leaning party. So I think it's pretty clear why John Kerry and John Edwards don't want to say that they're pro-draft, but do want to say they're thinking about the needs of our national security establishment.
Stephen, one of the things that's come up recently is this idea of heavy targeting of students. Young people are being recruited, and some of them are very, very young. Talk a little bit about that and give me your views on what you think it means that these children are being recruited.
Well, since we don't have a universal draft, the Army or the Department of Defense requires almost $3 billion a year to try to recruit young people voluntarily. And you only have to watch TV programs that are targeted at young people, for example, music television or the Comedy Channel, to see very slickly produced, wonderful advertisements extolling the virtues of getting your career training in the Navy or of being an army of one. And it makes it sound tremendously compelling, and they have very buff young actors playing these recruits, and they show it as being a mainly white, mainly tall, Aryan-looking army with the token people of other colors and genders. So, of course, they have to go out of their way since they're not allowed to draft people. And the problem is that there are very few limits on what they're allowed to say, just as is generally the case with advertising. They can say, get up to $18,000 for college, but they don't have to say, well, actually, only a couple percent of the recruits actually qualify for that, because most of you won't pass the right tests. And for us in the progressive movement, it's often been as much a non sequitur as though a bank said, oh, come on down to our bank and take out a $50,000 business loan to start your business. And, well, if your business fails, unfortunately, you will be an indentured servant to us for 7 to 10 years. But that's not irresponsible of us to invite you to make a decision that may be a very bad decision for your future. So the Army recruitment and the Department of Defense recruitment propaganda in general isn't really concerned about informing young people as to their options any more than a car ad is interested in informing you as to your auto purchase options. It's really about advocacy. It's really an advertising thing to say, here is the best thing that we can say about this option without being blatant liars and libeling ourselves. But it's very misleading that they say, everybody who comes into the Army will learn computer programming. You know, most people who go into the Army will be artillery people, and most people who go into the Navy will end up sweeping ships with a mop. Very few people who go into the Navy become aviators. Very few people who go into the Army become computer programmers. Another problem, just tangent, but it just occurred to me. I have a very dear friend whose son went into the Army and became a heavy equipment operator, learned to drive big trucks and tanks and plows and backhoes. And because of the way the Defense Department works, he came out with no job skills because all of the kinds of interfaces, the way the trucks are built for the Army and the way their backhoes and things work, are all completely different from the way they're done in civilian work. And I can guarantee that the same applies to computer software. There are even special programming languages used for the Department of Defense. So it's not like if you go in on one of these jaunts where they proposed the Department of Defense career path for you as being job training, that you'll come out with skills that you can actually use or that transfer directly into civilian skills.
Senator Fritz Hollings has been talking about Senate Bill S-89 that calls for an end to the all-volunteer military and the establishment of a compulsory two-year military term. Then there's the companion bill introduced by House Representative Charles Rangel, a Democrat from New York, and that's H.R. 163. Then there was, in November, the announcement that the DOD was looking for people to work in communities on draft boards. That would be selective service workers. Did you have more calls to your hotline when stories about these types of draft board implications came along?
Absolutely. Every time one of these news items airs, suddenly a lot of people, and they're often young men who are concerned, or young people who are concerned about a sibling of theirs, or parents of young people that might be impacted, start trying to inform themselves. And we see both the traffic on our hotline and also hits to our website increase of people just starting to inform themselves about how do I prepare myself to be classified as a conscientious objector should the draft be reinstated. And, of course, now it's looking more and more like that phrase should be when the draft is reinstated. But the problem for us is we don't know if the upcoming draft bill will have the same kind of provisions and the same definition of conscientious objection as it did in the past. In the past, there was a fairly specific definition that said conscientious objectors are people who have a moral or ethical objection to war in all forms. And so it couldn't be just a political decision that, for example, the war in Vietnam was a racist or a classist thing, and it couldn't just be against a particular war. So this definition is very well codified and is clarified in a number of court decisions, but pretty much the only thing we can be sure of is that they will probably come up with a new definition, should there even be a provision for conscientious objection in the new draft bill. Our assumption is they'll probably change what it means, and it may be broader and it may be narrower.
How much harder do you think that it's going to be for students and others to register as conscientious objectors now than it was just during the Vietnam War era in general?
Gosh, that's a very good question that nobody really knows. There are both extremes being bantered about in the public discussion. The one extreme being we should have a uniform draft with very few exceptions, but it should be much easier to opt to do alternative service. Should it be environmental work, work in the community, work in schools? This is what most European countries have, that it's absolutely required, but it's relatively easy to say, I just don't feel I can, in good conscience, carry a gun. And it doesn't have to be, you don't have as stringent a review process as we have traditionally had with selective service boards in this country to be classified as a conscientious objector. Other people have said they wouldn't mind the draft as long as it were easier, that anybody who could document an attitude of pacifism, a practice of pacifism, should be allowed to be classified as a conscientious objector and then released from any kind of service. So I think progressives can make the argument both ways as to should we have a draft or should we have some mechanism by which we compel some people into military service. You can argue pro or con as to whether it should be easy and how easy it should be and whether it should really just be people with a long religious background, either as Brethren or Mennonites or Quakers or Christian Scientists, any of these so-called peace churches, or whether it should be something that you just tick off a box and say, I don't want to carry a gun, but send me to a preschool to work, or send me out into the environment to clean up an oil spill. So it's a very interesting debate to have, and even people who consider themselves progressive can sit on both sides of the debate as to what the term should be or what the definition of conscientious objection should entail.
Now, I want to ask you how a person has to go about documenting that they're a person of conscience who couldn't fight a war. But first, explain to me what kinds of things are happening where you are as far as who's calling. Are they military enlisted personnel? Are they young people? Do they know anything about what's going on?
All of the above, I would have to say, Dori. We get some people who are already in the military, and there's a very large group to support people actively in the military who discover or have a change of heart or a change of faith, decide once in the military that they want to be classified and discharged as conscientious objectors. So there's a whole separate set of experts that do consultation with that, and because Santa Barbara has several Army and Navy and Air Force bases around it, or in the neighborhood, in the same area code, if people at any one of these bases start doing web searches on conscientious objection, they eventually find us. The second thing is often parents or young people just saying, how do I start a file? I heard that there might be a review, and I assume that this review is going to ask me questions, and how can I start documenting my faith or my practice of passive conscientious objection? And this is a large part of our activities, going into schools or tabling at the university and the City College in Santa Barbara, just to inform young people, if you think you are a conscientious objector and if you are worried about a possible reinstatement of the draft, here is the kind of things you want to be collecting. Should you get called before a draft board, they will say, well, if this is a passionate part of your life, your conscientious objection, and if this is something that you didn't just discover yesterday, certainly you can document it. And what we advise people is just to get a manila folder and start collecting things. Get pictures of themselves at peace marches. Write letters to the editor. Write articles for their school paper. Do things with their faith community, should they belong to a church or synagogue, related to peace issues. Get information and write book reports for their school about the history of pacifism and the Quaker peace testimony. So a large part of our counseling, when we get down to really the how-to of conscientious objection, is advising young people on how do you prepare a file so that you can document this should you be called before a selective service board. And there are, at least according to the definition of conscientious objection as it existed in past draft laws, it's very clear how you can document this and how you can document that it is a deeply held ethical or moral attitude and that it is an objection to war in all forms.
Stephen Pope is a member of the group Conscientious Objectors and Their Supporters in Santa Barbara, California. That's a local group affiliated with the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors and the local Quaker Friends and Unitarian Faith Communities. They provide CO counseling in person in local schools and universities and via telephone hotline to arrange counter-recruitment activities. They also have a document entitled Opting Out of the No Child Left Behind program on their website at create.ucsb.edu. I'm Dori Smith. At the start of this program, we provided some websites and a hotline. Here they are again. The American Friends Service Committee online is afsc.org. The Center on Conscience and War is at nisbco.org, and you can look up stopthedraft.org for further information on what's coming down the line. The GI Rights Hotline number is 1-800-394-9544. This program was produced in the studios of WHUS Doors, Radio for the People. For further information, write to me, Dori Smith, at rcrradio@aol.com. The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the station, its management, or the University of Connecticut.